7 in Elkhorn and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WPR News from Gateway Technical College.
Today on Code Switch, Mandrake the Magician, Madison Avenue, and the menace of menthol cigarettes.
The industry was doing black studies, and they were doing gender studies. They were interested in black masculinity long before black studies was an academic discipline. But they weren't interested in it because they were interested in black communities. They were interested in because they needed to figure out how to sell cigarettes effectively.
The fascinating history of how the tobacco industry created a stereotype.
Then on Life Kit, how to soothe your anxious thoughts with something called a stress reset.
Stress resets are quick ways to improve how you feel in minutes, and that allows you to do things that will help you solve problems rather than make things so much worse for yourself.
That's on Code Switch and Life Kit from NPR.
After this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Russian President Vladimir Putin apologized to Azerbaijan's leader today for the crash of an Azerbaijan airliner in Kazakhstan this week that killed 38 people. He called it a tragic incident. The Kremlin says Russian air defense systems were firing because of a Ukrainian drone strike, but he stopped short of saying that Russia was responsible for the crash. The health ministry in Gaza says Israel's army has detained the director of one of the last functioning hospitals in northern Gaza. The announcement comes after the Israeli military shut down the hospital, saying it was being used as an operating base for Hamas fighters. The hospital staff denies this. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
For weeks, the staff of Kamal Adwan Hospital in North Gaza refused to evacuate despite orders from the Israeli army. The hospital's director insisted that some of his patients would die if moved. But on Friday, after weeks of intense shelling and deadly strikes near the hospital, the Israeli military forcibly shut it down. The Gaza Health Authority said parts of the hospital were later burned down. This is Noor Al-Mukayyad, a nurse in the hospital's ICU unit. She said in a voice note shared by her sister with NPR that the Israeli military first set fire to buildings surrounding the hospital before shelling sections of the hospital itself. Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv, Israel.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the government will reach its debt limit by mid-January. NPR's Rafael Nam reports.
Sometime between January 14th and January 23rd, the U.S. will hit its debt limit. That's according to a letter sent by Yellen to Congress on Friday. But Yellen says the U.S. can adopt so-called extraordinary measures to continue paying its bills. These are essentially accounting moves to conserve cash, like suspending some planned investments. Yellen did not say how long the U.S. can do that for. Some analysts believe the U.S. could stretch its money until summer. But it would likely be up to the incoming Republican Congress and the next president, Donald Trump, to raise or suspend the debt ceiling. Otherwise, the U.S. risks a devastating default. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
The Department of Health and Human Services is considering whether healthcare providers should be required to do more to prevent cyber attacks. Ann Neuberger is the U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor for Cybersecurity. She says huge numbers of Americans have been affected by breaches of health information.
In the last 5 years, there's been an alarming growth, 1,002%, in the number of Americans affected by large breaches of healthcare information, over 167 million individuals in 2023 alone.
The proposed rule would require the healthcare providers to add new cybersecurity measures. You're listening to NPR News. Pro-Russian hackers are taking responsibility for a cyber attack in Italy today. Italy's cybersecurity agency says 10 official websites were hit, including the foreign ministry. It says it acted promptly and the impact of the attack was mitigated in a few hours. UNICEF says more than 473 million children live in areas affected by conflicts, a record high. These conflicts span the globe from Haiti to Lebanon, from Myanmar to the Democratic Republic of Congo. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel has more.
UNICEF says there are more conflicts now than at any point since World War II. And since the world's population has more than tripled since then, the total number of kids affected is at an all-time high. Joe English is with UNICEF.
Everywhere where we have data, the numbers are worse than they have ever been.
Growing up in a conflict zone makes a child more likely to be out of school and malnourished, he says. And there are often long-lasting impacts on a child's mental health. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
Actor Olivia Hussey has died. A statement from her family said she died peacefully at home yesterday, surrounded by loved ones. No cause was given. Hussey was 15 years old when she was cast as Juliet in the 1968 film adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. Hussey won a Golden Globe for her portrayal. Decades later, she and actor Leonard Whiting, who played Romeo, sued Paramount Pictures, alleging they were filmed in the nude without their knowledge. The lawsuit was dismissed. Olivia Hussey was 73. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
What's good? You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm B.A. Parker.
And this week on Code Switch, Mandrake the Magician, Madison Avenue, and the menace of menthol cigarettes. All right, Parker, I have a weird question for you.
Shoot.
Did you or anyone in your family smoke ever?
I don't smoke. I never have. Okay. Well, that's not true. I tried once in grad school, and I coughed too hard for that to ever become my personality. But a lot of my older aunts and uncles were lifetime smokers.
Okay. What kind of cigarettes did your aunts and uncles smoke? I'm curious.
Mainly Cools, okay. But there were a couple of Newports people.
Mm-hmm. Just as I suspected. Menthols, okay.
Yeah. Wait, what about you?
I smoked a cigarette one time in my life. I was drunk. It tasted like minty burning. Ugh. But my mom smoked for most of my young life. She quit when I went to college. Shout out to my moms. But she smoked Benson & Hedges menthol lights. I remember that mint green packaging that they used to come in.
I mean, that does sound classy. Benson & Hedges. It sounds kind of British.
Yeah.
Or like some 80s cop drama that aired on CBS, like Cagney and Lacey or Jake and the Fat Man.
Yes, as somebody who grew up in the 80s, I remember being a little kid and being able to buy her cigarettes from the carryout, like, for her. I was a little kid. I could go to the little cigarette machines with the funky little knobby Libra Jones. Oh, my God. What a time. Memory unlocked. Dark, dark times.
What a chaotic time. But, yeah, why do you ask?
Okay, so your people smoke menthols.
Mm-hmm.
My mom smoked menthols. The overwhelming majority of Black folks who smoke menthols.
I mean, my childhood best friend, she told me, still smokes menthols.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that's the stereotype. Black folks love Newports.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones I know do love Newports.
Yeah, it's a thing. And it turns out there's a whole wild, fascinating history that shows how Black folks became menthol smokers. It's a story that involves an actual, real-life, self-styled Black superhero / vigilante who made it his mission to free Black America from the thrall of the menthol.
Wait, what?
Parker, it is bananas. It's bananas. It's a story, though, that's also about, you know, Black civic leaders and civic institutions, some of which are very beloved, taking money from Big Tobacco. I mean, it's a story about these pioneering, ingenious marketing tactics, and maybe evil marketing tactics, that kind of came to shape the way we consume so many things today, not just cigarettes. And Parker, the fact that Black folks really, really go up for menthols has been at the center of a touchy policy fight that's been unfolding in Washington, D.C. for a while now.
Hmm. Okay, so I'm going to disappear for a while. Take it away, Gene.
It kind of all starts back in the early 2000s, 2009. The Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act basically bans flavoring in cigarettes.
That voice you're hearing belongs to
Margot Snipe. I'm the national health reporter at Capital B.
Capital B is a nonprofit news outlet that covers Black communities. And that 2009 law banned flavored cigarettes, like apple and cherry and honey, and the ban covered most flavors
except menthol cigarettes. So everything we've seen in the more recent years to ban the menthol flavoring is just kind of closing an open loophole on that first act.
The government didn't say exactly why they left that carve-out in the ban for menthols. But, okay, here's what we do know. Menthols make money. Younger people vape instead of smoking, right? We know that. Fewer people are smoking traditional, unflavored cigarettes. But menthols have become a bigger part of the pie when it comes to actual cigarette sales. RJR Reynolds makes Newports. Newports are the number one menthol brand in the U.S. And menthols have grown to half of RJR Reynolds sales in the U.S. now. So it's a product category that Big Tobacco has been doubling down on, and they were not going to let it go quietly. And two, again, black folks really love menthols.
So the vast majority of black smokers are smoking menthol cigarettes.
The Food and Drug Administration puts the number at 85%. Meanwhile, the American Lung Association says that only about 22% of white folks who smoke menthols. Margot said that there's this suspicion among some public health folks that that's part of why they let menthol slide with that ban on flavored cigarettes.
When I talk to advocates, it's the fact that black smokers are the people who smoke them the most, and so we can let them keep smoking it.
But Margot told me black folks tend to smoke fewer cigarettes, and they start smoking at a later age than white folks do. And because menthols feel less harsh to smoke, you know, because of that cool minty flavor, you can take deeper drags. That means you get more of the smoke and the nicotine into your lungs, and that makes menthols harder to quit. Margot said that's why the consequences of smoking hit black folks harder.
They're also more likely to die from smoking-related illnesses, and that's from data from the CDC. But tobacco use also bleeds into heart disease, cancer, and stroke, which are the three leading causes of death for black Americans.
And that's why so many public health advocates have been pushing for the federal government to finally ban menthols the way it did with other flavored cigarettes. The FDA actually proposed a ban on menthols back in 2022. Health advocates were excited. It was supposed to go into effect late last year in 2023. But then the Biden administration quietly delayed that ban from going into effect, or at least they tried to do it quietly.
This afternoon, community leaders and public health advocates marched toward the White House and staged a homegoing mock funeral for the 45,000 black lives lost to tobacco-related illnesses every year.
The White House, the administration has caught some fire for that choice.
Health advocates were stunned. They thought that Biden was playing politics with this. Margot said that some people wondered if maybe Joe Biden's people didn't want to go into an election year banning something that black folks, who of course make up the spine of his base, really liked. And look, I mean, are menthols even like a top 20 voting issue for black folks? I mean, I don't know, but Big Tobacco has the money and the motivation to make it an issue, or at least a talking point. Take this argument. Some civil rights and racial justice activists say banning menthols is just going to give cops another thing they can use as a pretext to stop black people.
It's a really complicated issue. What unraveled after that proposed ban was not really a battle of like what could be good or bad for the community or best or better. It was like a question of the most suitable of two potentially deadly evils. Are we smoking cigarettes, which could potentially cause lung cancer and other health complications, or are we further criminalizing black communities for possessing a product that's now banned?
As it stands right now, it's not clear when this proposed ban will go into effect, or if it even will at this point, but black folks are going to be central to its fate one way or another. Okay, so now for some history. I want to tell you a story about a dude who tried to save black people from what he saw as the scourge of menthol cigarettes. He even turned himself into something of a real-life black vigilante superhero like Meteor Man or Luke Cage without the dad. His name was Henry Brown, but to the people in the streets, he was
Mandrake the Magician.
I'm gonna tag in some help to tell this story.
Hit the button that makes me sound smart.
I don't have to do that. You're Josh Levine.
I am the editorial director of the One Year and Slow Burn podcasts for Slate.
You might remember Josh from the time he was on Code Switch before, talking about his book on the original Welfare Queen, an absolutely bananas story that you should go listen to if you haven't. Anyway, Josh and the folks at 1 Year recently did a whole episode on Henry Brown.
Henry Brown was born in the South Side of Chicago in the 1930s in a black community. He was in the military, got out, became a court reporter, was civically minded, really cared about his community.
Anyway, superhero origin story time. One Mother's Day, Henry Brown is driving around Chicago. He's with his girlfriend, they're with their moms, and you know, Chicago is notoriously very segregated.
And they just watched the landscape change.
On the South Side, the black side, there were ads on billboards for menthol brands like Kool's and Newports and Virginia Slims everywhere. Images of young, fly black people, you know, getting their lives with cigarettes in their hands. On the sides of buildings, on billboards, on the top of buildings, just everywhere. But on the north side, the white side of town, there was nothing like that. And that pissed Henry off.
He had this kind of belief, based on what he saw just in the urban environment, that people that looked like him, people in communities of color, were being targeted explicitly by tobacco companies. And this was a thing that felt both offensive and actually maybe he had the kind of hubris or self-belief to think that he could do something about it.
And so Henry decides he needs to change the landscape, literally. And since, again, nobody else is going to do it.
What he decided to do was to whitewash them.
And so his idea was to take some paint and a roller,
to get a ladder, to climb up there, and to paint over the ads. And what his daughter told me, he didn't paint over the whole thing.
Henry didn't want people to see just like a painted white rectangle where the billboard should have been. No, he wanted those images of beautiful black people smiling, living their lives, clutching their cigarettes. He wanted them to look defaced.
That's the kind of some of the brilliance here of the strategy. He painted over enough so that if you wandered by, if you're on the bus, if you walk past, you could tell that there was a cigarette ad under there.
Henry and his girlfriend Gwen will go around black Chicago and surreptitiously deface these billboards. And their vandalism, vigilantism, direct action, it started to get people to really pay attention.
Immediately, people started noticing. People in Chicago, journalists, the billboard companies, and the tobacco companies. Just like with the radio station, he claimed credit, but not under his own name. Hmm. And that just added to the mystique. The guy who painted over the billboards wasn't Henry Brown, the kind of middle class, single dad, court reporter in Chicago.
No, he was claiming credit under a new name.
It was Mandrake the Magician.
Mandrake the Magician, after this old-timey comic book character from his childhood. And Mandrake's whole thing in the comics was he's making evil disappear. So Henry starts to give interviews to the press, dressed in a mask and a top hat. And of course, he keeps calling into that radio show as Mandrake.
The AP interviewed him as Mandrake, the anonymous billboard painter. And anything that's a mystery, anything that you've got like a superhero kind of name, it instantly becomes fascinating to everybody.
So some people decided they wanted to get on board. And so they started following Mandrake's example, defacing and painting over the cigarette ads that wallpapered their street corners and billboards. There were protests and rallies and direct actions in inner cities around the country where people started demanding that these tobacco companies take down these billboards for menthol cigarettes. Henry Brown died in 1996. And while he's no longer a household name, the burgeoning anti-cigarette movement that he helped catalyze has not been forgotten in his hometown of Chicago. There's a park with a playground and a rec center on the South Side today that bears his name, or his nom de plume, I guess. It's called Mandrake Park.
So many different people were outraged about the same thing at the same time. And he, I think, gave inspiration to people, some of whom just directly followed in his footsteps, and it worked. Like, look at, you know, where we live in D.C., Gene, look anywhere in the U.S., and what don't you see?
You don't see these ads anymore.
Yeah. No, and You know, was it because of one person? No. Did one person who was just a guy who, you know, called into a radio station and decided that he needed to do a little bit more, did he play a major role? Yeah, he definitely did.
When we come back, how menthols became the cigarette for Black people.
The industry was interested in Black masculinity long before Black studies was an academic discipline, but they weren't interested in because they were interested in Black communities. They were interested in because they needed to figure out how to sell cigarettes.
That's coming up. Stay with us. You're listening to Code Switch from NPR.
When you give to Wisconsin Public Radio, you have a powerful impact. You make WPR a place that hundreds of thousands of people turn to for independent news, national conversations, and Wisconsin stories, as well as laughter just when it's needed. WPR is listener-supported, and that means you make a difference. Make your year-end gift right now at wpr.org/donate. Thank you.
WPR is your source for essential news, compelling conversations, and smart entertainment. This service is available on air, on the app, and at WPR.org, with gifts from tens of thousands of members. Thank you for your support.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started and pre-planning, visit CaseyFamilyOptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
What's good, y'all? You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm B.A. Parker.
So we've been talking about Black people and tobacco, specifically menthol cigarettes, which reminds me of this old Dave Chappelle sketch. It's called I Know Black People.
Gene, like, are we really talking about Dave Chappelle in 2024?
Parker, I'm so sorry. I know.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I remember it, sort of. It was like a quiz show, right?
I know Black people!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People.
And Chappelle was a host asking folks questions about Black people, and one of those questions was...
Why do Black people love menthol so much?
Yes, and the contestant says...
I don't know.
That is correct.
All right.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Well, it turns out Chappelle was wrong.
Wouldn't be the first time.
It turns out that actually somebody does know.
All right, let's hear it. I'm going to go away again.
My name is Keith Whalew.
Keith is a historian at Princeton, and he literally wrote the book on how this came to be.
I'm the author of a book called Pushing Cool, Big Tobacco, Racial Marketing, and the Untold Story of the Menthol Cigarette.
And just like Henry Brown / Mandrake, Keith said he first noticed that something was going on when he was a kid in the 1970s, and his neighborhood in New York was covered with ads for menthols on billboards in magazines.
You saw Black, you know, people enjoying life with a cigarette in their mouth. And I didn't realize at the time how novel this was, you know, partly because the U.S. government had recently banned radio and television ads, and the industry really pivoted hard into Black neighborhoods and into billboard advertising at that moment. So, and then I moved out to New Jersey, a sort of suburban community, to finish high school. And I'm like, where are all the billboard ads. We were all the menthol ads. And, you know, it had to do with the sort of geography of marketing, but it also had to do with the geography of race, because if I went down to the next city over, which is Newark, New Jersey, there they were again.
But let's back up a bit. Keith said the menthol cigarette was first developed way, way back in the 1920s. It was marketed as a kind of less harsh, healthier, I'm doing air quotes, healthier alternative to regular cigarettes.
Because menthol, you know, has that distinctive feeling in your nose and throat. It feels like coolness. It feels like your airways are expanding. It isn't. It's what one scientist called a perversion of sensation. It makes you feel healthy. And so that's why lozenges have menthol, and that's why Vicks VapoRub has menthol. And so the menthol cigarette emerged as a cigarette where the industry said, like, if you have smoker's throat, if you are smoking a cigarette and you need a break, then smoke a menthol. So, and even in the 1950s, you know, the makers of Cool had these ads with Willy the Penguin.
Switch from hot to snow fresh filter.
Cool. Cool, snow fresh. Cool.
Who would say, you know, to the viewers of these cartoons, when April showers make you cough like crazy, refreshing Cools taste fresh as a daisy. You know, switch from hots to cools. And so it was all medication oriented.
And that was around the time that health experts first started making the connection between smoking and lung cancer. So the cigarette companies really leaned into this notion of healthier cigarettes more broadly. It's in the 1960s that the tobacco companies changed tack and really, really start selling menthols to black folks.
What happened in the 50s is Congress stepped in and regulators stepped in and really threatened the industry and said, you know, we don't want you recruiting young people as the next generation of smokers. The industry pulls out of advertising on college campuses, and where do they go? They pivot to these cities that are changing demographically, that are increasingly black, and that's where the story of how menthol became a black cigarette preference starts.
So fast forward a few decades to the 1990s, there was this giant lawsuit in which a bunch of states sued the tobacco industry. They wanted the tobacco companies to pay for the healthcare costs of all the people who were dying from smoking-related illnesses. The tobacco companies settled that lawsuit with the states, but not before they had to turn over decades and decades of documents and memos, papers that showed how and why and to whom they were selling their products.
And suddenly, all of this material about how the industry built its markets, how they thought about race, how they thought about black people, why they started to pivot to menthol marketing in the city, all that became publicly available.
What's wild about those documents is just how sophisticated and deliberate they were about trying to hook black folks and how targeted their tactics were. The tobacco companies could really hone in on black people as a demographic because in big cities, black people all lived in the same places, hashtag housing segregation and everything. And Keith said the cigarette companies studied those black neighborhoods really, really carefully.
They were interested in, like, segregation. They were interested in neighborhood dynamics on street corners. The industry was doing black studies, and they were doing gender studies. They were interested in black masculinity long before black studies was an academic discipline, long before gender studies.
As one example, the tobacco companies realized the Marlboro Man, a white dude with a cowboy hat on a horse, that wasn't going to play with black men the way it did for white men. So they started to become interested in what black men thought of as cool, what made black women feel stylish.
But they weren't interested in because they were interested in black communities. They were interested in because they needed to figure out how to sell cigarettes effectively. And so you don't know whether to be, like, amazed by the material that they were able to document about the nature of black life or whether to be horrified by it.
When the tobacco companies were doing these, I don't know, ethnographic, sociological deep dives, they tried to figure out who the social mavens in these neighborhoods were.
They're not looking at, like, the the president of the bank or the local leader of the PT.